Okay, we're here, and we're live on Crusade Radio. And, folks, this is John Garash, G-A-R-A-S-H, in New York, the co-founder of the National Liberty Alliance. John, before we get into your national organization, it's already starting, got alliances and contacts in 48 states. Will you please give us a little of your background?
Well, basically, I'm just regular people. I don't have any higher education than most people anyway, and nothing thrilling about my background. Pretty much I've taught the Bible for quite a few years, and I guess that's where I get my ability to speak.
Okay. And in addition to teaching the Bible, you've been involved in a lot of politics, right?
Well, I've gotten involved in the political process. My engagement in what I'm doing, I guess, started about the late 90s when I had problems with the IRS, and I discovered that, the courts aren't what they we expected them to be. And so it's been a battle of many years. They never got me, but they've been trying for a long time. But yeah, I got involved in the movement, the Ron Paul movement. I think it was about 2007 or 2008, and then over into the Tea Party movement. And then we started looking into what was the committeeman process, and we discovered some problems with that the committeeman process had been taken over by two private associations called the Democratic and the Republican parties. So they're kind of a seized process. The committeeman process was originally put out for a grassroots movement for the people to actually control the political process. And, of course, that doesn't happen in these parties that have taken control of that system. It's a top-down operation. These positions are supposed to be elected, and they do make them look like they're elected, but these people aren't elected. They're actually elected at a private meeting. They just put a facade on to make it look like they have been elected. But they are supposed to be elected positions. We discovered that as we studied the election law here in New York State. And when we confronted the New York State Board of Election to talk with them about the problem that they weren't permitting elected, people to become elected and to become committeemen, they just stonewalled us. And that's been the start of our legal understanding. We started to look at the legal process because we decided we were going to sue. We certainly didn't want to use a lawyer. And we started looking into the common law. And as the years went by, we then discovered this here, which is the grand jury.
And based on the Fifth Amendment of the Bill of Rights, right?
Right, yeah. We got a case. I had seen this case a little early on when we were studying common law, but I really didn't look at it close enough. And it's the United States versus Williams. It was a 1992 case. And Anton Scalia from the United States Supreme Court wrote the decision on that. And it was a 6-3 ruling, so it was a pretty powerful ruling. And in that, he laid out the power of the grand jury. Apparently, when you read the case, there was no need for Scalia to write all that he did. But I think he was just looking for something to put his work into. Clearly, he had done a lot of, studying in this matter. And so he researched it, and he put all his research in this case, it seems. So he gave us a lot of ammunition, a lot of cases and history. And May or so, roughly, earlier this year, someone sent me a copy of that and told me, John, you got to read this. And so when I read through it, I realized that we had to start to change focus and we had to work on this grand jury thing. We started in New York, and by July 18th, we had our first grand jury reinstated here in New York State in Dutchess County, New York. And within a few months after that, we've had 17, and we filed all of those grand juries, and we've been in battle since. And we now have 21 grand juries in New York State out of 62 counties. We went national, not by choice. We were kind of drafted into that. But we went national around that time, I guess. And now we have 48 states heavily entrenched in the grand jury process. We have some states that got quite a few grand juries already in the process of the election. They've been reinstated. And some of them are getting ready to file, you know, any day now. And it's moving very quickly across the nation. We have, you know, we started off with a handful of people, you know, 8 months ago or so. And we now have thousands of people across the nation diligently working on this project.
Very well, John. I just want to make sure the gentleman you and I talked to, and the three of us had a conference call here a few days ago, is Jim Cook. Jim, are you there?
Yes, Douglas, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, how you doing, Jim?
And so,
good.
How about this? Why don't you read the Article 5 of the Bill of Rights? Which discusses the grand jury, so people understand, because most people have forgotten whatever they learned in school or were never even taught the Bill of Rights. If you don't have it in front of you, I've got it here handy. I can read it, but do you have it available?
Are you looking for the Fifth Amendment in the Bill of Rights, you mean?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it says, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or an indictment of a grand jury, except in cases rising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject for for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, but shall be compelled, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And, of course, our focus here is on the fact that you can't be charged without presentment or indictment.
Okay, now...
And basically, you know, what that is really saying here is that the government does not have the authority to charge you and put you in jail at all. They have to get the permission of the people every time they do it. Without fail.
That's very important. Now, people know that they have grand juries in their counties, in every state in the union. I think they mentioned today maybe there's one that doesn't have that right anymore. But the fact is that why, if the Bill of Rights call for a grand jury and we already have grand juries in the counties, why are you forming common law grand juries?
Well, the grand juries that exist today, they're all puppet grand juries. There's been a battle about grand juries since the beginning of our nation. You know, right when the Constitution was finalized in 1789, George Washington had attended a lecture by some individual back in his day who was a expert, you know, on law. And he was discussing the grand jury. You know, George Washington was a strong supporter of the grand jury, of course, and so was Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas Jefferson said that you can trust the people with the control of their government, and he was really speaking about the grand jury. He had a couple of statements he had made that are very strong concerning the grand jury. The grand jury is... the pearl of our nation. It's what we were created upon. It's unalienable rights, and it is one of our unalienable rights. But it is the grand jury that, you know, makes us who and what we are. You do away with the grand jury, you now have tyranny. This battle has been raging for over 200 years. I just read a paper recently, someone had sent to me. We do have it up on our website, and our website is National Liberty Alliance.org, and on that page, I'm trying to think of the name of this. Grand Jury Under Attack. It was written in 1955, and it goes back to tell the story and the battle, ultimately the assault upon the grand jury since the inception back in 1789. And the first two parts, it's broken up in three parts. The first two parts are kind of depressing as you're reading through it because they're just beating it up and beating it up and beating it up. But, of course, the story is focusing in on certain areas within our nation. Meanwhile, the grand jury had been was being used throughout. A lot of the states that were coming in, there was a movement, and the movement was sponsored by the Bar Association. All of these individuals were involved in the bar, and you know, they're all lawyers and judges, and they worked overtime to get rid of the grand jury, complaining that it was not very efficient, that they didn't have the understanding of law, they weren't qualified, and just going on and on and on. And of course, their law is very complex. Their law is the law of man, and you know, our law is natural law, is really common sense, and we're ruled by principles and maxims. They are ruled by statutes, and they don't make a ruling outside of a statute. But in any event, this has been a battle for almost 200 years. But as time went on, you know, the United States Supreme Court, surprisingly, had been pretty much an advocate of the grand jury, and we have a lot of rulings. You know, we have the, what is that, the Madison case, I forget the name of the case, something versus Madison. And in that case was 1802, and they said that anything that was repugnant to the Constitution was null and void. I think it was Marbury versus Madison. Yeah, that's what it was. And anyway, it was null and void. And that has been the standpoint of the United States Supreme Court. Now, the assault upon the grand juries really were taking place mostly in the states. And a lot of the state constitutions, there was a race to distort the state constitutions in order to eliminate the grand jury and various other freedoms that we have. And that's why some of our state constitutions are written pretty poorly. And over the years, of course, as we started to move from 13 states to 14 to 16 to 20 and to 30 and so on, as we moved further out west, the assault was already there in the workings, trying to prevent any power of the grand jury within their constitutions. But the bottom line is anyone who signed into the Union, all of the states that signed into that contract, they were governed by the U.S. Constitution, which, of course, has the Bill of Rights. And it is written in the Bill of Rights, the Fifth Amendment is the only place you find any authority or concern about the grand jury, and therefore it is left up to the people. It's an unalienable right. We get to make it up as we go. We get to decide what is law and what isn't law. And we get to decide what the punishments are. And we get to decide how the person is going to be reinstated that was violated by a particular individual, a defendant. Of course, they don't like that.
John, could I ask you a question? I want to go back to something you said when you first started talking about this. You said that the puppet strings of the courts were that the grand juries that they have now are puppets of the court. Now, as far as my understanding of back in the 1800s, the late 1800s, what was going on in this country is as people were brought into court, they found that a lot of the laws that were being passed were unconstitutional. So back during that time, they were able to judge the law as well as the facts of the case. But nowadays, the judges and the grand juries are given instructions by the judge especially in the courts, to judge the facts of the law rather than whether the whether the law is constitutional or not. And what we found out was happening ever since the 1800s is that the laws of other nations, which didn't codify the Constitution or obey the Constitution, were beginning to be fed into our system of justice. Now, what is your take on the instructions to the juries by the judge? Is that constitution? Is that legal? What is your take on that?
Well, it's repugnant to liberty. It's repugnant to natural law. Again, it's the people that make the decision. The question is, are we under man's law or are we under God's law? Unfortunately, we've all been brainwashed here in the United States to believe we're under man's law. We don't call it that. We call them statutes. Statutes are not law. The United States Supreme Court has ruled over and over and over again that statutes are not law. Statutes are law only to the bureaucrat, to the elected individual, to the appointed individual. That's what statutes are. People who we give certain authority, they're our servants, and they have certain authorities and responsibilities that they need to fulfill. And when they break those authorities, that contract, then they violate the law that we, the people, of course, hired the legislators to write. So that's law for them. But any law that comes out to control your behavior, any statute that controls your behavior, says that you need a license to drive or you need a permission to have a weapon, to carry a weapon, or anything of that nature, that's repugnant to the Constitution. That's your business to control, not the government's business. So any law that controls your behavior is null and void. Now, we consent to it every day when we're called into court, usually sometimes kidnapped into court by the police department, and they will bring us before a judge, and then we'll plead, and now we've consented. If you don't plead, you're not consenting. But this whole system of laws by men, this goes all the way back to Babylonia. There's a book called Common Law by Brent Winters, I think his name is. And it really goes and tells a good story of the history of common law, where it came from, and also the battle of the other side, which ultimately is we look at maybe a civil law, Roman law, Justinian law. And it's what we call today civil law. And it is statutes, and it comes out of Babylonia. The whole thing is to control. The Bar Association brings all these statutes and puts the statutes above the Constitution, and there it is, the battle. But when you go into a courtroom and you have a jury, the jury is the king's bench. We just recently finished a study on that, and it's called Extraordinary Remedies. And that also is up on our Juris Document page on nationallibertyalliance.org. And if you read through that, I believe it's only a few pages, 5 or 8 pages long. I think it's 5 pages. And the study records the fact that it's the king's bench is where justice comes from. That's called the tribunal. And that's made up of numerous judges. And all of the judges on the king's bench is to reflect the will of the king. They're the reflectors of the king. And they're the judges of the king. Well, we the people are the reflectors of the king. We're the judges of the king. And the king are the American people. All of us are kings. This is the great experiment. And so we represent the kings. And so the king himself sits on this bench. And outside of from this bench comes forth the common law writs, the writ of mandamus, the writ of habeas corpus.
John, wasn't that codified in the Chisholm versus Georgia case, where the ruling of the court back in 1793 specified that when we kicked the King of England out of the United States, that the sovereignty devolved onto the people, where we became kings. Is that not true?
Absolutely. That's the point. You're the king. My kingdom ends where your kingdom begins. As long as I don't violate your kingdom, we're good. The moment I violate your kingdom, I just broke the law. And it's that simple. It doesn't get any more difficult than that. And so each one of us is a king. This is the big experiment. This is the big American experiment. You see, you got to understand the purpose of the king and where that came from. You know, the king really came, the idea of the king came somewhere around maybe 500-600 A.D. It is the Anglo-Saxons, when they came to England, and they brought with them this idea of they were in a pursuit. They were pursuing how to be ruled by God and not by men. And they were being ruled over by what's called maxims. And maxims are, for instance, a maxim is something that is a truth that cannot be denied. A simple maxim, for instance, is water cannot run uphill. You can't argue that point. A thing similar is not necessarily the same thing. It doesn't matter how similar it is, it's not necessarily the same thing. That's a fact. It's a maxim. You can't argue it. All men are created equal. That's a fact. That's a maxim. So this is the kind of rulings that they brought in to England with them. And then they met up with the Bible when they were in England, and they found that the Bible, their opinion, was the first law book, because they believed it was written by God, because they didn't believe that laws should be written down, and that each case was unique unto its own. And therein is really the birth of natural law at that point. Then they established a king, and the purpose of the king was to represent the freemen, which would be the dukes, and they had different names for different people, but it would be the freemen. And so if a freeman had a problem or a situation, that's what they put the king in the throne for. They'd chase down the king wherever he was, and he'd open the court wherever they were, and the king reflected the will of the king, which was the will of all of the kings, which were the freemen. And that's how the process went. From time to time, they got a wicked king, and that's what happened in 1215 when they chased down the king along the road and put an axe to his head. And that was the birth on paper of the grand jury, which we find in Article 61. Now, that was the birth of the grand jury there was in its infancy, because at that point, of course, they were bringing the point out that the people got to rule, and they got to make the decision. No government or one individual makes the decision. And so they brought the king back into order, of course. But they did violate the king's right to a trial, his right to due process. And, of course, they corrected that. And what we have today is the grand jury is pretty much what is written, we see there in paragraph 61 of the Magna Carta. And so when the king's bench comes in,
can you, with that being said, can you address the jurisdictions of the courts as far as statutory law and common law and what the differences are?
In common law, there is no statutes in common law. When you come into the courts of common law, it's pure natural law. The documents lay forth the principles of common law. Common law is led by principles. Matter of fact, the word justice, if you look it up in the Black's Law Dictionary, is synonymous with virtue. Okay, and virtue is the essence of God. Whatsoever things are good, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things of good report, and so on. That's virtue. And so common law, the rule of common law, and the principles of common law is that the people are there to discover the truth of a matter and find justice. And so they must enter in with a sense of honor, a sense of justice, and a sense of mercy. That's the principles by which all jurists act upon. Obviously, our jurists today don't act upon that at all. I'm talking about the actual judges, they're professional jurists. And of course, the other ones are the jurists that they bring in. They're just puppet jurists. They will follow and do whatever the prosecutor tells them, as far as the grand jury is concerned. And once they get into the court, they're obedient to the judge, and they follow whatever rules he sets forth. So they're puppet juries. They don't have control. You see, a true jurist, which is the people, they would have total control. They get not only to make the decision whether a person is innocent or guilty, and to discover and decide on what law is good or not, and we're looking at natural law now, forget statutes, they don't even consider them. And then they also get the chance, they get the opportunity to decide what the penalty would be. And the penalties in a common law court is always looking to reinstate, to reestablish the injured party. There are two major principles, or shall I say maxims, that we work on, that all jurists work on. One is, in order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party, and the state cannot be that injured party. The second is that for every injury, there must be a remedy. It's not that it's nice to be a remedy, it's got to be a remedy. So jail isn't necessarily the focus of a jury, whether it be grand or trial. The purpose and the focus of the jury is how are we going to reinstate the individual that has been injured here? And is this person guilty of that injury? And if that person is guilty of that injury, well, we got to do something to reinstate this person, to make them whole again, to return whatever damages, to repair the damages. Our law does not work that way. Our law is all about money, the law that's in place right now, it's civil law. And that's illegal, by the way. It's unconstitutional. It's unnatural. It's not what we the people put in place. We've been robbed by the Bar Association, ultimately. and all of these lawyers and judges, the minions of the New World Order, working to enslave the people through these statutes. This is how they did it in Germany. This is how they did it. They do it everywhere. They incarcerate them in their statutes, bring them totally under control, and little by little it gets worse. And we're at that point. We're at that boiling point here in America. So
now, can I chime in here to what you just said and support your supposition? There's what is known as corpus delicti, which is Latin for body of crime. Corp meaning body, dead body, and delicti meaning of crime. So basically, under that and in common law, isn't it well known that you must either have injury, loss, or harm and a victim, and injury pertains if you hurt somebody, harm if you do them verbal damage and rupture their character, and loss if you cause them loss, like in a contractual agreement, you break the contract and somebody loses money somewhere down the line. And there must always, in injury, loss, or harm, always be a victim.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. That's the basis of common law. America was established on common law. It's in the Constitution. The Supremacy Clause makes it clear. All of these judges take oaths, and that's why, you know, the first thing you want to do when you start to go into courts is get their oaths. I went to seize the oaths of every judge in my county, and I'm going to start teaching other people to do the same thing, and we'll put them online so people can go in. The first thing you want to do is intimidate the judge. You want to let them know that you accept the oaths and the bonds of all the officers of this court, and then you'll attach the exhibits of this individual's oaths and bonds if you can find a bond. It's a game being played right now with the bonds. I'm looking into them. But nevertheless, that's the first order of business, because these people have taken an oath, but they're acting under corporate charter. The United States is incorporated. Every state is incorporated, every county is incorporated, every town, municipality, whether city, town, or whatever, is incorporated, and that is the definition, ultimately, of Nazism. All of these institutions or these corporations are in it for profit. They are making profit. A lot of us are aware of the CAFA funds and those kind of things, but there's a profit. When a judge puts someone in jail, there's money to be made. And that gets into the UCC stuff to understand where that money comes from and some other various places. But there's money to be made. So it is advantageous for the judge to find a person guilty to either, fleece them for whatever money they can get out of them with fines or whatever, or put them in jail and they'll get a check through the UCC situation, you know, from the government. And that's the game that's going on. It's nothing about justice. As a matter of fact, when an individual is injured, and when a crime has been committed, and they'll bring them in to witness in their own case, and then they throw them out in the streets. And these people may rake thousands and thousands of dollars, and yet the victim sees nothing. They have to go hire a lawyer and spend more money just to try to get some restitution. They can't get it. But common law requires restitution. And common law is in our Constitution. And we own those brick-and-mortar buildings, and we intend on taking them back, and all we have to do is go in there and turn the shingle back around. Instead of the state of New York, it's New York State. Instead of the United States of America.
Right. Now, I want to address something you said earlier. You said, the courts are really set up for civil law, and that's under the Uniform Commercial Code.
Comes from another place, but go ahead.
Okay, but my understanding is that in order to be in court in a non-corpus delicti situation, like, say, you run a stop sign or you're speeding or whatever, where there's no victim or injury, loss, or harm, you have to somehow enter into a contract with that court for them to proceed. Now, how is that done?
That's right. There has to be. It can't be done. You see, they go off the idea that we're not civilized and we wouldn't obey these things, so they have to arrest us, which isn't true. I mean, there's plenty. We have a video on the line that shows that that's not true. As a matter of fact, things work out a lot better when you don't have traffic lights and you don't have all these stop signs or anything. You know, if you put up a situation where you put all these yellow marks, especially when you go through a town, And you'll find that people will yield to each other. The cars will yield to each other. You know, you just put up the necessary signals to let it know be slow. This is where pedestrians cross. And you find traffic flows a lot quicker. You know, there's situations of there's one town who I think was done in England where they did this. And the people were interviewed. They thought it was crazy. Ah, this would never work. People are going to get killed. Meanwhile, people have been killed on that street. And what they discovered is when people come to a red light, for instance, and they're sitting there, they're busy watching that red light. As soon as that red light hits, their foot's on the gas pedal and someone walks in front of them and they hit them. They're not paying attention to what they're doing. Well, when they put covers over all these lights and they just removed all of these things, and then people just went about their business, and there was like a magic, there was like a flow, it was like a harmony, you know, people yielding to each other, cars moving, and people were able to get from one end of the town to the other end of the town in less than half the time. Even the people walking through the town that said, hey, it used to take me 25 minutes to get here, I do this in less than 10. And and they haven't had an accident since. And this experiment went on for quite some time. So that proves that people can do things without having to be controlled by a government. You know, crime disappears when people have the ability to have a weapon, and nobody knows who has a weapon, and crime disappears. Because most criminals, first of all, they're cowards anyway, and they're nothing by themselves. But the bottom line is they don't know whether you have a gun or not, and they're not gonna bother you. You see, that in itself deters everything. Drugs. You take away drugs, you just eliminated drugs in school. You know, all the illegal drugs, or all of the cartels, or all kinds of crime, you just eliminated completely. Yeah, you know, drugs aren't good for you, but it's much safer for it to be legal than illegal. Now, people can't do drugs in the streets, just like you can't drink alcohol in the streets. Why? Because we have children. Our families are there, and that would be corruptions of a minor, and that would be a damage. So that's obviously logical. You know, so those kind of things could be understood and appreciated. You know, there are different things that we could be very creative on how to control things. Maybe a problem that has with a person that's an alcoholic and maybe is driving a vehicle under the influence. There are different ways to deal with that than to make it a criminal thing. Okay. In any event, once you control, if you are in control of your behavior, that's what it's all about, being a king. And if you're not in control of your behavior, then someone else is your king. You're a slave to them.
Now, with that being said, and also, let's say you get in an incident where you supposedly have to appear in court. I hear that some people, what they do is they send on the ticket or the summons. I refuse to contract. They send that back in. Or when they get into court, they'll challenge the jurisdiction of the court. Now, have you ever used that process, or do you know how to use that process?
Yeah, I've returned numerous tickets, and they've never come back on me. I usually write on 3-4 times across diagonally, return for cause, and they leave me alone. It's been pretty successful, you know, but it may not be successful for everyone. There is a judge that he wrote a paper, and matter of fact, we have that up on our Juris Document also. It's called The Judicial Process. And it's not that long. It's only 8 pages. And the judge's name is Judge Dale. Now, this was much longer than this. The whole thing is about 96 pages. It gets into a lot of philosophical thinking and belief. And he does explain some of the things on how things work. But I think some of his thinking was distorted. But in any event, you know, I think he was on the mark, and I think he's one of us. He retired early because he couldn't take all the crap that was going on. And then he wrote this paper. And in the end of the paper, mostly is the last 8 pages, which is what we posted. And he lays out exactly the procedure and the process, how you can beat any ticket. And if you followed his principle here, I think you could win pretty much any ticket. You do have to answer in court, you know. You got to be careful. I mean, traffic ticket, they're not going to necessarily come out to arrest, and you can respond in writing, and usually they'll find you guilty, send you, you know, an amount you got to pay, and if you don't, eventually they take your license away and they go through all that stuff. But if you go through this process, you should be able to beat all those and not even go to court. Of course, if you were detained for maybe driving without a license, and they give you a date to come to court, you better go to court, because they probably will come out to arrest you. The big thing about that is to come in and make the point that you're here only by special appearance. In other words, you're just here to test the warrant. You don't think it's real, and you're not obeying. You're not responding to the warrant. You're just here to test it. And then you can follow these procedures that this guy has. I write my own papers for it and challenge the jurisdiction. They don't have the jurisdiction. They never had, and I never gave them consent. Often those cases will go back and forth for months. They don't know what to do with you, and they keep bringing you back, and eventually they'll let you go, usually. But sometimes there are problems, and it depends on how many feathers you ruffle. And, the prosecutor usually gets upset about all this. So they may try some of these tactics. The usual tactics that they eventually come up with is to try to claim that you're incompetent and that we have to give you a lawyer. See, as soon as you lawyer up, that's it. You're in the games. You signed up, and you're going to pay the consequences. And, yeah, they may make a deal in the back rooms. All that. If you want to go get involved with criminalities, go hire a lawyer. But if you want justice, then you know what? You have to learn it. Jefferson said, if a people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be. You know, my knowledge of common law and understanding what's going on has only come about in the last couple of years, 3 years or so, that we've been looking into it. It doesn't take a lot to figure this out. It's all logical. It's common sense. Once you start looking at the principles and the maxims, it comes very easily. And it's all really about American history is really what it boils down to be, the Federalist Papers, the conversations, the arguments, the 17th century philosophers, which is what our founding fathers cut their political eye teeth on, so to speak. This is all interesting stuff because, liberty is popular. It's interesting. When you start looking at this stuff, it's very interesting. And what is it that makes the essence of a man? You know, the essence of a man is his spiritual relation, his political relationship, that which decides his future, okay? And what is just in his life. And he has to have control of justice and his political process and his spiritual relationship with God. He's got to be in control of that. And if he's not, then he's not a man. And they have taught us that when you have a religious experience that you want to deal with, go find a priest or a pastor or a rabbi or something, you know? And if you have a legal problem, go hire a lawyer. And if you think things aren't going good for you and you really want to change things, go join a political party. Well, they robbed us. They robbed us of our liberty, because that is liberty. It is free. True freedom is liberty. Liberty is natural law, and liberty is the control of your future and your being and your right to pursue happiness. And that's what gives you happiness, the fact that you do have liberty and the fact that you can have a relationship with your God. And the fact that you can rest assured you're going to have justice in your life and for your children and your family. So without that, we're nothing. And so we're creatures of we're slaves. If we don't have control of those three attributes of our life, we are slaves, and we're controlled by someone else.
John, now addressing the spiritual aspect, if you go back to 1 Samuel 8 in the Bible, it was the prophet who is talking to the people who requested that they have a
king.
Give
us a king, yep.
So they,
that was Samuel.
Right. And during that, God got angry because God says, it's not you that they affront, it is me, because right. They had a god who went before him rather than a king, and God got upset. And then he made this statement, and it reflects what's happening today. He said, if you get a king, they're going to steal your birthright, they're going to take your men for their army, they're going to take your women as concubines. So God had laid out to his prophet to tell the people that a king is going to rob you blind and make you servants to him.
Right,
and,
well, that's where England went astray. That's when they failed that. The Anglo-Saxons, when they went through this process in England and they went and got a king because they didn't see any other way, they made the very same mistake that the Jews made when they came to Samuel asking him for that. And then the Lord said to Samuel, go tell the people, I'm your king, okay? You don't need a king. I'm your king. You already got one, okay? And that's the point. That's what natural law is all about. You see, we already got a king, and we are kings, and the Lord is the king of kings. And that's the key to this whole thing. We come to a bent knee to his law. He is the king, and we yield to him. So, I always tell people, I don't get too involved in what religion people might believe and think. I I have my faith, and I understand what I understand, and I just try to reflect what I believe is truth. And people, by God's will be wherever they go. But I tell people, look, you got to work things out in your prayer closet. And once you work out things in your prayer closet, you get your spiritual life together, now you can start working on your justice problem and your political problem. And it's a very simple thing. Just do the right thing. Everybody knows what the right thing is. Whatever it is in the life that you've come in contact with, there's a right and there's a wrong. And you just make the right decision on every little detail, and you're good. And God will put before you all this work, and you just make the little decisions. It doesn't get any more complex than that. And that's the whole process here. But yeah, they made that big mistake, and they went after a king, and they pulled down Saul, and Saul, they ran into all kinds of problems. But then, of course, we know the story of David and so on. But here, I think we have the same situation. We had Washington, they were going to make him a king, because they wanted to return back to that same monarchy thing. The very same thing, because they understood that. But our founding fathers had a different belief, a different philosophy, a different strategy. Not only came from the Bible and the understanding, let's not give the people a king, but also, you know, they had the experience of the 17th century philosophers who were writing, and they were all writing and studying the Bible and common law. And they were standing on the shoulders of giants, and we too now today stand on the shoulders of giants by standing on our founding fathers. But that's where they established this idea, let the people be the king. Everyone is a king, okay? And you have a Supreme Court ruling that tells us that we're all kings, kings without servants. But ultimately we do have servants. They're called government servants, but they don't act like servants. They act like the masters. But the bottom line is Washington said, no, I'm not going to be king. And we have a republic. We're going to be a nation under the law of God, natural law. And that's what was established. So we did make the right step. The grand jury's been struggling for 200 years.
If we could, John, let's go back to what you just said and address how the state turns it around on us, because I know the Constitution of Virginia states that all power proceeds from the people, which means that the people are above the state, because we have the right to contract and do all this, and
correct.
The state, in order to get us under them, have written the code in such a way as to make us think that we have to go get a license if we want to do business and all of this. And once we enter into that contract, they now put our kingship to servants by saying, okay, now we're over you because you have contracted and you have entered into a civil contract.
They defrauded us into that contract. We never willingly, knowingly went into that contract. But go ahead.
That's correct. Now, can you address all the mechanisms by which the state, or at least some of the mechanisms by which the state draws us into contract violation? I think it's UCC
1-307. It's pretty simple. They control our religion. They control our education. They control our media or entertainment. They control our political process. They control our judicial process. We are slaves. And it's when you wake up and realize I'm going to reject all these things. I'm going to be free. I'm going to have liberty. You can nullify everything. And that's an uphill battle. You have to get out your sword, so to speak, and fight it. And it's a battle uphill, but it's an enjoyable battle. It has a reward at the end of it. Sometimes it's got some pains with it, but it has a reward. And if enough people start doing it, we can all win it back, and we can turn this whole thing, you know, back right side up again. And that's what our movement here is about, the Common Law Grand Jury. We have 3,141 counties in the United States, and it is our intention to find a grand jury in each and every one of them, because in each and every one of them there is a court, and we have to take the courts back and bring them back under the common law, and that's our plan, okay? But we are founded under, of course, the Declaration of Independence. And the beginning of the Declaration of Independence lays it out that we have government by the consent of the people. That's what we are founded upon. Anybody who defrauds, and we claim it under natural law, so it comes from God, it's unalienable rights that we have. So no man can break that or take that away. No legislator can turn that around. They don't have the authority to turn around. Anything they do on that is fraud. And when we put the Constitution together, the preamble to the Constitution said, we the people did establish and ordain this Constitution for the United States of America. We're above the Constitution. We're the ordainers. We're the kings. They are the servants. And so all the legislators, you know, and the administration and the judicial system, they work for us. They're underneath us. You know, the United States Supreme Court knows this, and they've mentioned this numerous times, that the people are far more powerful than them. And there's a lot of Supreme Court rulings that they made, and they said, we don't have the ability to overrule the grand jury. That court is higher than us. We can't overrule them. No matter what they rule, we have to live with. For right or for wrong, that's the ruling. The only time they can go against and maybe do battle with the grand jury or a trial jury is if they clearly violate the rights, the unalienable rights of another individual. Therefore, they have the duty to defend that individual even against the grand jury. But that's the key thing to this whole thing. You see, we're above the Constitution. They're under the Constitution. This whole system, we're not supposed to have judges in our court. We're supposed to have justices. Justices are synonymous with virtue. Go into Black's Law Dictionary, Bouvier's, you'll find the same thing, that it's synonymous with virtue. So they're supposed to be reflecting the king. The judge in a courtroom is a magistrate. He's kind of the traffic cop. He keeps things going, keeps things on the move, but he's always looking to the will of the tribunal, which is the sovereign of the court. And that the tribunal could be a number of things. It could be the jury, but it could be the sovereign of the court who is the plaintiff. It depends. If this isn't necessarily a criminal case, but it's a civil case in the sense that there's a contract dispute, and an individual comes in and is the plaintiff and understands that he's the sovereign of the court, and he opens up a court of record, now this whole court system has to be operated under common law. And if the other side's brain dead and doesn't understand that they need to ask for a jury, otherwise the sovereign of the court's going to make the decision at the end, and that's where the big surprise comes in. Okay? People will learn that quite quickly. I'm going to ask for a jury, or they're going to become a counter-plaintiff, and then they have to have a jury. So you have two plaintiffs. But the bottom line is that the judge is not to make a decision. He is not the tribunal. As a matter of fact, in our study that I had mentioned earlier, which is the extraordinary remedies, in this study, it lays out the power of the king's bench, and the king's bench is that tribunal. And it says in itself that the Supreme Court itself is found in the king's bench. So when the Supreme Court in itself never opens up just because people are in there talking or because there's a judge there or anything else. It opens up when the sovereign enters the court. That's when the Supreme Court opens up. And that's why all our courts right now, people don't understand their sovereign. They don't take up the position of the sovereign, nor is there juries in most of these courts. So you have these judges, and if there are, they're puppet juries. But so these judges take advantage of that, and none of our courts are common law courts. But when a grand jury comes into session because it finds a wrongdoing somewhere and it tries to fix that wrongdoing to arbitrate it, and it can't fix it, maybe four or five of them will go out and try to fix the problem. If they can't fix the problem, then they bring it to the 25. And once that 25 is called into session, the king's bench is now open. The Supreme Court in that county is now open. And that Supreme Court has the power to arrest you for contempt and fine you for contempt. So if they give you a command, you got to obey it. And if you don't obey it, they can get you for contempt. They can put you in jail or they can fine you. When that Supreme Court makes a decision, the grand jury decides to put forth a true bill, if it believes that the person is guilty and they have to be indicted or presented, it's called a presentment, but it's a true bill of indictment, and they decide, okay, I'm going to put this forward and we're going to file it into the courts. When they file that into the courts, the judge has no choice but to sign that paper, and it goes forward and it's handed off to the trial jury. Now obviously the grand jury can't try them because they already believe they're guilty. They've already seen too much. They have to hand it off to someone else who comes at it from a different point of view. Yeah.
Now
at the end of the hour, we only have 3 seconds left.
Okay.
Close with prayer, John.
I'm sorry, say it again.
Will you please close with prayer?
Oh, sure. Most holy, gracious Father, we're thankful, Lord. We praise thee, Lord, because thou indeed art God, and there is none other God beside thee. We confess that we're witnesses. We pray that thou be merciful upon us over the coming days. We know that evil is upon the world, and by God's mercy and movement in our hearts, we may be able to bring justice back into this world by your will. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Gotta run. Good night, folks.
God bless.
God bless. Godspeed, everybody.
Bye.